Welcome to the Traverse City National Writers Series. Over the course of the next hour, you will hear excerpts from the third event of the 2010 schedule, an evening with poet and memoirist Mary Carr. The Traverse City National Writers Series is an exciting new event bringing some of the brightest celebrities of the literary world to Northern Michigan. Founded in 2009, the National Writers Series is dedicated to hosting great conversations with some of today's best authors, journalists, and premier storytellers. The host of tonight's program, Brian Grewley, is at the podium preparing to introduce Mary Carr.
We're very fortunate tonight to have as our guest Mary Carr. Mary comes from East Texas, a little town called Leechfield, which in reading her books, I thought, you know, imagine, say, Mancelona on the Gulf of Mexico. And she had an eventful life, eventful childhood, eventful adolescence, eventful, for lack of a better word, adulthood. Her mother was an alcoholic who once threatened her and her sister with a butcher knife to kill them and ended up temporarily in a mental institution. Her father was also an alcoholic. He used to hide a bottle in his truck in the garage and go out there and drink at night alone. And eventually that cost him his life. And Mary herself hung out on beaches with hippies and did hallucinogenic drugs and barely escaped staying in jail for more than one or two nights. An aspiring poet came out of this girl, and she ended up in New England at Cambridge, Harvard, where she married into a very wealthy family and began to drink. And the image that sticks with me is of her huddled in a closet with a bottle of whiskey in one hand and a bottle of Listerine in the other, as if the one alcohol would mask the smell of the other alcohol, even though she had a little boy named Dev, who's now 23 years old. But Mary underwent a profound transformation. She stopped drinking, and she found a higher power that she chose to call God. In fact, she was specific enough to call it a Catholic God. But that's not really why, I tell stories. What Mary's great gift to me is, having read her work, is she's a storyteller. She's that person who sits out on your deck in the Adirondack chairs overlooking Skagamog Lake, Elk Lake, Torch Lake, Blue Lake, Duck Lake, Walleye Lake, Starvation Lake, whatever lake, you know, and keeps you up until the June sun goes down at 9:53 or 9:54 p.m. She's that person who can cast a bottle off a beach with a message in it, and someone is compelled to take up that bottle and read that message. And through the power of her language and her honesty, you get to feel what somebody else felt like. Let me read you just one very short passage. After 90 days without drinking, in one of her early attempts to stop, Mary goes to a poetry reading where she's the star and proceeds to get cockeyed drunk and almost crashes into a concrete wall and ends up coming home many, many hours later, and her husband is up. "I'm sober enough by this time, and gushing apologies. You should be sorry," he says. He heads up the stairs, turning back to add a sentence of a type and tone he never uses with me. And again, I remember it so clearly because it was so out of character for him. "You smell like a bum." Which is my moment of clarity. Not blinding flash, nor drunk tank revelation. Not drinking out of a turkey's innards, not settling myself afire, but the dull thunk of reality as my husband's muscled calves carry him upstairs. A moment of deep self-loathing makes not drinking seem your only conceivable option. But I know that day how swiftly such moments pass, how cunning, baffling, and powerful my own logic can be. My head is grinding inside like a pepper mill, and by dawn, a hangover has landed a cold hatchet in the back of my skull. Now, I am allegedly a writer, but if I tried turns of phrases like Mary, I would separate a shoulder. So I'm going to bring her out here in a minute, but before she does, just between us, I think we have the harder job tonight. I mean, Mary just has to come out here and answer questions. If you've read her work, you know you cannot ask her a question that is too personal. And she knows all the answers. So it's up to us. I'm going to ask some questions, and I'm going to ask you to ask some good questions. It's up to us to entertain her. I'm sure you're going to be entertained. I'm sure I'm going to be entertained. So let's entertain our guest, Mary Carr. Mary, let's have a big Northern Michigan welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. You get so overstimulated. Sort of like a birthday party where you've had too much sugar, you know? It can only end with weeping.
Is that my cue? Hi.
Hello, honey. Y'all don't have to entertain me at all. I'm self-amusing.
Mr. Grooley declined to comment. You've been to Northern Michigan before?
I have. In fact, I think in 1980, I swam just down the street in the bay with my to-be husband when we were driving cross-country. So amazing.
And it was colder than hell, right?
Yes, it was quite chilly. But I went to college in Minnesota, so I was schooled in this.
And what Carleton? What college was that?
McAllister.
Ah.
I called it Lackluster College. It's a miracle they let me in, and I was such an ingrate. Sort of the story of my life, ingratitude.
So I'm going to read a little bit of your sterling prose here. And this is from Lit. Mary's third.
Available model. To you for a pittance outside.
For a pittance. That's right. Like two lattes at Starbucks. If I ever wonder what made me a writer, if I tug the thread of that urgent need I have to put marks on paper, it invariably leads me back to Mother, sprawled in bed with a luminous hangover, and how some book of rhymes I've done in crayon and stapled together could puncture the soap bubble of her misery. Why do writers write, Mary?
I think it's why everybody does everything. I think we want to be loved. If only we knew that there were much better ways, like sucking up.
You do say in one of your books that that's an overrated.
No,
or
it's
underrated
sucking
because
up
it works
is
so well.
Because for given how well it works, that's right. But I think, yeah, I mean, for me, it really does go back to my mother, who was a complicated individual. I mean, both my parents were drunks, but I loved them enormously. My mother was also enormously glamorous. She was an intellectual. She'd studied painting in New York, and she had fancy clothes in this little house we had in the Ringworm Belt. You know, I started very early memorizing Shakespeare, in part because I realized it would get her attention. So my sister and I would learn the speeches of the Shakespeare plays, and I'd, you know, put a sheet on and I'd be Wen's woman's countryman, you know, with a little coat hanger laurel on my head. I grew up in the house of poetry. I worshipped in the cathedral of poetry, in the church of poetry.
Is that about the words and the craft itself, or is it more about I'm a ham? I want attention.
Oh, no.
See me, feel me, hear me.
You don't understand how little attention there was to get. There wasn't that much attention to get in my house.
But you would strive for it.
Yeah, you would strive for it. But it wasn't, it was also reading the poems and memorizing them. I spent a lot of time doing that, and mm-hmm. the recitation might take a minute. but I would spend hours and weeks and days. It, for me, poetry is Eucharistic. It's like it's like a communion, you know, when you take someone else's suffering into your body. Well, Doug Stanton said it, you're made more human, which is a line from both Sir Philip Sidney and Percy Bysshe Shelley, that you're humanized, you're made more alive. But, and I had this, I was a lonely little weird kid, partly richly provoked into that by my household, but also I think it's my disposition. I was a dark, minded, Kafkaesque child. And I would read a book of poems, and if it was something that I knew something about feeling, I would feel less lonely. If it was something that I thought had happened to me too, I would feel less lonely. And if it was something I hadn't felt, it would make me curious. And it actually, I think, changed what I projected on the landscape, because I think I was scared and inward and very worried. And to read a poem was to connect with other human beings, not just the invisible poet, but I could actually look at other people and think, you know, they might feel how I feel.
But you were not 8 or 9 years old. You knew you were lonely. Could you be that conscious when you're 8 or 9?
I'll tell you, the first poem I ever wrote, which I still have a copy of, I consider it my first poem. It's just a little piece of writing. My grandmother was dying, and it says, "There was a car wreck with a man 3 feet tall. Here is the man." And then there's a car sitting on a man. That's not very clearly a man or a car, but you kind of get the vague idea. That's the kind of stuff I was thinking about.
You are listening to the third program of the 2010 Traverse City National Writers Series, An Evening with Mary Carr.
A friend of mine once told me, this is way back then when I was in college, said, to be a writer, you have to have some level of narcissism because you have to think what you have to say is important.
Absolutely. I mean, even when you don't have anything to say, that was the other thing, is I was so in love with writers. I mean, I actually teared up being here and thinking about young Ernest Hemingway. 30 minutes from here, I was just rereading his short stories. You know, my eyes welled up to think about his doctor father teaching him how to shuck empty shells from a shotgun, you know, the two would-be suicides out marching around in the mm-hmm. Michigan woods. And so I just worshiped. These were the writers to me were the people who knew about psychology and sex and love and terror and death, and, you know, they were cool and they knew about music and history, and they had this glamour that just seemed impossible. Of course, I'd never met one, but in my so-called mind.
What was the first book you read? Not poetry, but fiction or nonfiction that you said, wow, this is just, I love this.
Probably the Winnie the Pooh books, the A. Milne books.
Really?
Which I read before I was 5, and I memorized all the little poems, a lot of the little Christopher Robin poems. And I also started memorizing Cummings before I was 5. So, novels, you know, I remember To Kill a Mockingbird, like everybody.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
Huck Finn, so a lot of those books. But I read a lot of poems. I memorized J. Alfred Prufrock when I was like 12. I was such a nerd ball.
Let me read something here that Mary wrote.
Oh no, it's so embarrassing to have people, it's like people looking through your underwear drawer. You know, and holding up your, like, panties with the elastic out of the leg.
Yeah. Well, here's one with a few holes in it.
I hope they're in the right places.
Oh, I'm in the wrong book. Wrong drawer. This is when Mary had, I'm sorry if I'm spoiling these books for you, but you should still go read them, had discovered that her mother was actually married before. 6 other times.
Just a little thing. Just a little thing. A couple of marriages.
7? I'm barely have time for one.
And at what point, at what point do you say to yourself, maybe it's not them? Is it number 3? You know, I've been engaged twice. I've been divorced 15 years. I guess more than that, like 18, almost 20 years I've been divorced. And I've been engaged twice. So that's almost like being married three times.
Almost.
Almost. It's close, but not the same.
Nope.
But at some point, you've got to say, you know, maybe it's not them.
Well, it's not like Mickey Rooney or somebody who's trying to get on the cover of Us magazine by getting married and unmarried and all that. This was just,
I don't know. I don't know what it was. She didn't date, she married. That's what we said.
So, Mary writes, as to why Mother hadn't told us all of this before, about the marriages and the lost children, her exact sentence stays lodged in my head, for it's one of the more pathetic sentences a 60-year-old woman can be caught uttering. I thought you wouldn't like me anymore.
Isn't that sad?
Truly sad. Yeah.
It's really sad. Yeah, my mother was that's the thing. I had enormous, and still have, enormous empathy for her. She was very charming and very capricious. And she didn't take very good care of us, but she didn't take very good care of herself either. You know, it's not like she was a skilled taker care of, and she denied it of us, for us in particular. She would really think that as her kids, that we would just not like her and, like, not associate with her. So funny.
But if you read what she does in her life, I thought the line was very sad, but I'm thinking, You were drunk, you abandoned them, you moved them, you abused them, you didn't make dinner for them.
Hey, the dinner was the least of my problems. You can rustle up something to eat, you know. You really can. I was just, I'm not even going to go into it. I've been on the road.
Oh, no,
I'm sorry,
please.
But I'm like,
that's
no,
why
no,
we're
no,
here.
No.
Go into it.
No, I'm not. I've been on 83 airplanes. And you find yourself, I found myself eating, you know, that chili, that crummy stuff that you put water in. But I checked into they put me in an inn they thought was like scenic, but had no hot water and no room service. And you're eating the dry chili out of the chili thing.
You were in Ohio then, it sounds like.
I was actually in Wisconsin. It was that or cheese. I went with the chili.
Well, what about your mom? If you read the books, you're going to learn a ton about your mom. But just
so here's a story about.
Tell me about your mom.
Here's a story about my mother. When my brother-in-law first came to meet her, my sister's second and hopefully final husband, came to my house. I was having her kitchen retiled, and the tile dude pries a tile off and holds it up and says to my little gray-haired 80-year-old mother, "Why, Miss Carr, this looks like a bullet hole," because there's a perfectly round hole in the tile. And my sister says, "Isn't that where you shot at Daddy?" The boyfriend and the tile dude both go, she says, "No, that's where I shot at Larry. Over there is where I shot at your daddy." You kind of got to like somebody like that. Or when she was dying on her deathbed, she was so hilarious. It's, you know, the nurses came in, and she's lying there, and it's all somber, and we're all and the nurse comes in and says, "Miss Carr, your husband's here." She says, "Well, he must look like hell. He's been dead 10 years. I mean, she never missed a beat. She was a funny, you know, at one point we said, she promised me that she would babysit for my kid, which was not really going to happen, but I ran at that football, you know, like I believed, you believe that she's going to do this thing she promises. And,
what did she say? She said, "Not much for kids or something?"
No, she said, "I don't do kids."
That was it, yeah, like Windows.
Yeah, "I don't do kids." I said, "Mother, one, you had four. Number next, you promised me you would do it. Number three, you don't cook, you don't clean, you haven't had a job in 45 years. What exactly do you bring to the party?" And she kind of went like, "Oh, like I forgot to do anything for 70 years.
I'm fun to hang around with." Is that what she said?
She said, "I'm a lot of fun to be with."
"I'm a lot of fun to be with."
I said, "That's true, you are." So that's true. She was a lot of fun to be with.
And yet, you know, you unloaded on your mother.
Oh, God.
But I mean, the big time at the end of Lit, in you moved her into a new apartment, and she was pouting and
you have to say the worst thing that I did, didn't you? Right here in front of these nice
Midwestern
people.
I'm going to read a little bit of it. And
It's really.
If I had a beeper up here, it would be about every fourth word. So You told your mother, the truth is you never had the balls to paint, mother. You were too scared to reveal your ugly self to the world, so you stayed home. And you vomited all that pent-up poison on all of us. And having made not a single plan for your old age, you sit in the house we paid for, trying to screech me back into submission. I don't think so, mother. You don't like it here? Get in your car and go. Alicia and I will sell this place and enjoy the first vacation either of us has had in years. You selfish. And you know what? When I read that, I felt good.
Yeah.
I'm like, you go, girl. Exactly. She deserves
right.
this.
Well, she's,
and know. Then 2 pages later, you're apologizing. What are you apologizing for?
You know, she was 83 years. You know, she's 80 years old. She just moved. She was a, you know, she was a sad little human unit. You know, it's not that I didn't genuinely mean it, but there are some things best kept to oneself. You know, the new Christian speaks, right? I'd just been baptized, right? I was trying to be a Christian. This is why I need Jesus.
You shall not lie.
I am a big win for Jesus, let me tell you. You have to ride the subway with me, you know. This is a true. So yeah, I had a complicated relationship with my mother. That's, you can drag all that up. But I'm pretty hard to embarrass, you have to admit.
Yep. I will concede that. But your father, I really liked Pete Carr.
Oh, you know, my father was like, he was like Rhett Butler. I mean, he was like Clark Gable or something. Yeah, I remember seeing the first boy I ever kissed in Liars Club, John Cleary.
Yeah.
Who said, your daddy was like the epitome of what a man was. He was like a man's man. He was like,
yep.
Had been a D-Day and he could, you know, ride horses and, you know, he fought all the time. He gambled.
He was at D-Day?
I'm sorry?
He was there that day?
I think day 3 or something.
My second cousin lost his leg there.
Well, my father kept both of his.
Good for him.
But, you know, it's all his limbs.
I think you're more your daddy's girl than your mama's girl.
Oh, I was
aren't
much
you?
More of a daddy's girl. I was much more. I mean, he would take me. The Liars Club, the name of the Liars Club comes from this group of men that he gambled and shot pool with. And I was just like, I rode along in a car with him and sat on the bar in the American Legion in this little town and listened to these amazing stories. He was great. You know, the reason he told stories so well is. The books were one thing, but the vernacular of my father, I mean, he used to say, for instance, of a sort of plump woman, she has a butt like 2 bulldogs in a bag. That's a line of poetry, I think. So, you know, I think I fell in love with poetry as much from E.E. Cummings or William Shakespeare, and
father.
Also with my father. He was a great storyteller, which he did because he gambled so much, and people are less likely to shoot you if they think you're funny. Just FYI. Trying to look out for you guys. The new Catholic. Oh, God, forgive me.
The day, I'm reading now, the day I moved Daddy to the hospital, he grabs my arm as we cross the lawn. The checks I sent home never paid down the guilt I tote today for having disappeared from the place he's dying in, which is, in turn, a place dying in me.
Mm.
My life with Warren, her husband, Mary's husband, ex-husband, somehow excludes my daddy. The me daddy knew doesn't exist in Warren's house, which is maybe why my husband didn't come down on this mission, down being the operative word. Where I came from is a come down. Daddy's last upright public appearance was on the bar stool in the VFW, where one final shot of whiskey felled him the way German snipers had failed to. In an increasingly skeletal form, he kept breathing, though each week he sanded closer to the bone. But he'd been floating farther from me, starting when I'd left him. Or he'd left me, I never could decide, more than a decade before. The ambulance door seals me inside with him. Daddy's good hand wipes his wet face, then swats my hand away. You know, reading so
poor
much about...
Poor old Daddy. Poor old Pete.
Your mom and your dad.
Now I know why I don't reread these suckers.
Yeah. Occasionally.
It's really hard.
Huddling in the closet with the Listerine and whiskey.
I thought it was supposed to be a funny book.
No,
that's what all the reviews say, it's funny.
You want to use those little mint things. Listerine is not going to cut it, girl. Do you think? I think you made peace with your mother. I'm not sure you made peace with your father.
Oh, absolutely, I did.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. Pete Carr would not have wanted me to feel bad about his dying.
Well, I understand that, but it's not about Pete Carr. It's about you.
Yeah, but I mean, I was 30 years old. I was, I paid for his nursing, which at that time was $12,000 a year, which was
a lot of money.
A lot of money for a poet. And that was about all I could do. It's sad.
You know, when I started, I read the books in chronological order. And when I was reading Cherry, it dawned on me, there's this conspicuous absence, at least to me, maybe I missed it, mm-hmm. in Liar's Club, the first book, mm-hmm. of friends, like
That's
your pal.
That's not true.
I just didn't feel them
I
as much
friends.
As I did. Well, I know you had them. I just meant on the page. It was so much more.
How many friends do you have, Brian?
Millions.
See, they like me better.
As they should. You're better looking.
No, but you out-earned me.
I doubt that, girl.
I think I had two really good friends, which is more than most people get in high school. And I had a great sister. I had a big sister.
I was talking more about as a writer's decision. It just seemed the first book is much more focused on the nuclear family.
Sure.
And the second book has a lot of your friends, including your closest ones, Meredith and Clarice.
Right, and Dooney.
And Dooney later.
Drug
on.
Dealer, yeah. Dooney, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's still my best friend.
He's the fat Elvis, right?
Oh, don't say that he's
fat
Elvis.
You said that.
Not for public consumption. It's a private thing. He's gained a little weight.
Sorry, Dooney. I am the fat Elvis.
He had a great, last time I saw him in New York, he has a great big diamond watch with three diamonds on it. I said, what are those diamonds for? He says, the three whores in my life, alcohol, cocaine, and Karen.
Well, at least he can afford the diamonds.
That's exactly right. He said, I got it the old-fashioned way. I sold dope for it. He doesn't actually sell dope anymore. It was an inside joke. He has a construction company. So he's not in concrete or anything. Not in cement and contracting, though.
So I laughed many times reading this, but I don't know why, but the one line that I just, it was yesterday, I was reading, finishing Lit, was when you were contemplating suicide.
Oh, I'm glad you think that's so funny.
Well,
right. Sad when my daddy's dying, not poor old me.
Didn't get to the line yet, but somebody must have called you for lunch, and you wrote, I can interrupt my death for lunch, right?
That's exactly right. I could get dressed up and go to lunch. Sure. Exactly.
Can you? I mean, everybody will get discouraged or whatever with wherever they're in life, and I should just kill myself. But you went a lot farther than that. Can you go into that moment now, and tell us what you know?
No.
Well, you wrote about it.
I know, but that's they can pay $26 to read about it. It's going to be much better, believe me. It's not a good soundbite. It doesn't make a good soundbite. It does much better when you read sort of the whole thing around it because it's hard to condense in like one moment. I wish I could do. That's why I had to write 400 pages.
And
you go into it yourself.
And you, I haven't been there yet.
I was very depressed. I had a major depression. I was probably depressed most of my life. And I always say, mental health professionals and teachers and librarians saved my life. And when I checked into the Mental Marriott, which was a mental institution in Cambridge, so famous that the guys when I checked in who brought me, taking all my, my purse and everything away from me, joked that I should put it on my resume. Everybody from Harvard checks in here, you should put it on your resume. But it was a great turning point in my life. I loved it there. I was only there 3 weeks. And it was a place that I surrendered. I couldn't quit drinking. And I was starting to almost drive into stuff. And I had a friend, I call her Joan the Bone, who was suggesting that I try to pray. And I'd never believed in any kind of God. And she said, why don't you pray on your knees every day for 30 days and see if your life gets better? I mean, what does it cost you? And I think I started praying when I was in the Mental Marriott. I think, you think, my best thinking got me here. you know, this is ill-advised. People frown on this.
You think?
That's right.
And you were just getting like some huge fellowship or something. You were in there, you had to get out.
I had to get out so I could go to Radcliffe to get the Bunting Fellowship, which, by the way, I went to the first tee at Radcliffe College. They had tees. You can imagine.
That's not golf.
Meet a tee. That's exactly right. I'm not comfortable in a golf situation either. I wore flip-flops on the green last week and got chased off. I went wearing the little plastic bracelet. I was like shoving it up my jacket sleeve. I came with like a handler. You know, like she didn't have me on a leash or harness or anything. I wasn't in the jacket. But yeah, I mean, I had to get out on a day pass to go to the first tee at Radcliffe College. I wonder if they'd done that before. I wonder if I should write them and thank them for the fellowship. So, yeah, I know. No, it was good. It was a good thing.
You say, I think it's early in Liars Club, right? Maybe it's in the preface that you talk about. It is in the preface where you say, I haven't gone back to read this, except when you asked to read little excerpts and stuff. And I think you quote Ian McEwan as saying, if you're promoting your old work, you're like, you're an employee of your former self.
You're an employee of your, that's right.
And I thought, and reading, I thought, what if 10 years from now, somebody asked you, gave you a big, big check, said, I want you to go back and rewrite Liars Club, knowing what you know now. Would it be different?
It'd have to be a really big check, Brian. I mean, I really do.
Okay, it's a really big check.
No, I really do these things based on prayer now. I know this is like, you know, everybody thinks first of all, I'm not just Christian, I'm Catholic. I pray about what to write, and I turned down for this book a big boatload of money in the year 2000, the year Cherry came out. I had two different publishers offer me these big fat advances, and partly because through prayer I came to the decision that I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write a book of poems. Mm-hmm. My Republican sister went haywire. You did what? You turned down how much? You know, you just stop calling home collect. I'm not sure this is a good idea. I think you should reconsider this. So my agent was nice about it. And then 3 years later, I had an idea about how to write it. But I needed the money in some ways worse the first time I turned it down. So I really do make these decisions in this kind of nutty, voodoo Catholic way, through a whole series of prayers and, you know.
Reading the three books in succession, you can get the feeling at times that you actually plan them out. I doubt that's what it is, but I'm going to ask you. Because there's a lot of... You know, the prologue to Cherry actually plays out in Lit.
Mm-hmm.
And there are
I never noticed that.
Different.
No.
I'm telling them.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, there are these double backs, which I found really gratifying because they change a little.
Mm-hmm.
On your father's death and your mother's various rants and
my mother's jackpots. I think we remember through a filter of self. It is true. I think the point you're making is that whatever self you are now is different. And so obviously, I think when your self changes, you remember yourself. It's why, you know, when your heart is broken because, you know, Gary whomever, like, won't dance with you in the seventh mm-hmm. grade and you sob yourself sick and your mother says, you'll laugh about this someday. If you were that same person, if you occupied that same self, you would still be crying about it 50 years later, but you're this other human who kind of looks back on that. So I think we do remember things very differently. But I really don't read these books. I mean, I really don't write them to help people. I'm the one person in America who's not writing a book to help everybody. I am writing a book for money. I'm the one. I'm not Oprah. Oprah does all this stuff for free. So yeah, I mean, I am somewhat guided by prayer in the writing of them, and I do try to tell the truth as much as I know it, but they're really hard for me to write. These are really hard. I mean, I threw out 2,000, we were talking about this at dinner tonight, 2,000 finished pages of this book before I finished it, and I sort of had a gun to my head. At one point, I considered selling my apartment and giving them the money back. So that tells you how dire.
Why did you throw out the pages? You mean the writing wasn't good, or it wasn't true, or
you know, what? It's funny because the events were not that different, but they lacked some kind of emotional veracity. Mm-hmm. The example I like to give is like an event can be the same event, but if you know there's something emotionally untrue about it, and you know Jeffrey Wolfe was at one point in his life writing a biography of Herman Melville. And I remember talking to him about it, and I'd read some apocryphal story about Melville. And Jeffrey said, no. I said, well, what about that story where he's home at Christmas and he has all these oranges and his daughter wants the oranges and he's locked in his room eating them, keeping his child from this fruit when they were very poor? And Jeffrey said, he had scurvy. That one piece of information makes the event completely different.
Right.
So, you know, people, I mean, there's James Fryer in your business, there's Jason Blair, there are people who just manufacture stuff. That's the least of what you're worried about. And people say there's a thin line between fiction and nonfiction. Guess what? No, there isn't. It's not hard, Mr. Fry. If it didn't happen, you don't write it down that it did. This is not complicated.
Yeah.
But the minute you write about one thing instead of another thing, you've begun to shape a narrative. And if I tell the story, and I remember discovering this in Liars Club, telling a story about my mother having a big fight with my father on my birthday and sailing. He walked out, you know, and she has a lasagna, which was then a very exotic thing to have. People didn't eat. She'd been married to an Italian, we later found out. And she...
at least one.
At least one. made her a good cook. And she sails this lasagna after him. And I remember writing it that way and then realizing that she went out and cleaned it up and she also had a German chocolate cake and we went on with my birthday. That is a different story. The story ends with her sailing it out. It's not that the thing doesn't stop there, but the minute you start to leave things out, I'm trying to create an emotional experience in the reader. So the truth is, none of this would have been a problem. I could have just, you know, gotten the keys to the highway and a credit card and stuck my thumb out, and that would have been the end of my problems, right? But she was also, she tried, you know.
Like most of us.
Like most of us.
Yeah. So tell us about how you write. Like, would you get up in the morning and write at night?
I get up and write in
write longhand,
I
laptop.
Get right in the morning. I like to write longhand, but it's hard for me to write longhand when I'm working on a big piece of prose. I don't know if you find this, but your back hurts or my back goes out, I have a shoulder, I developed a repetitive stress injury during Cherry. So at the end of Lit, my boyfriend would get up in the morning, leave the house, I would get up, I would pop open a Diet Coke. This is like heroin for me. Now that I don't drink anymore, this is like instead of snorting cocaine, I drink Coke.
Slightly less good for you.
Yeah,
go
exactly.
Ahead.
But, and I would flip open my laptop, and lying down, I would write maybe from, say, 7 in the morning till noon. Then I would get up, and I would eat something, and I would go move to my desk downstairs, and then I would, like, start my day over.
Huh.
And I would sort of move from place to place in my apartment. And I also did this thing where I was so under the gun, and it was so hard for me, that I didn't get out of the house at all, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I didn't answer the phone, and I didn't check email. And Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, if you had a key to my apartment, there was a chance that I would talk to you. So my son and my boyfriend could see me.
This was after you threw away all those pages.
Right.
And you had a deadline,
right.
I presume?
Right. So this was like August of 2008 when the manuscript was supposed to be done in January.
The following January. I see.
Yeah.
January 09.
Yeah, so I had like 4 months. I had 120 pages.
Now, do you rewrite as you work?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, as you work, or do you write
No.
And then go back?
No, I swim.
I do more of that. So.
Well, that's the way a normal person does it. That's the way Stephen King, a real prose writer, does it. I'm a poet, and I get so engaged in the lapidary work of making a sentence that I have to sort of rewrite. And then, so it's very arcane. It's an inefficient way to do it. I could never be a journalist. They would kill me. But I would just, and then on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I may or may not see you, but I did answer email in the afternoons and answer the phone in the afternoon.
You are listening to the third program of the 2010 Traverse City National Writers Series, An Evening with Mary Carr.
In Liars Club, you mentioned you're shopping with Daddy, with Pete Carr, at a GI surplus, Army surplus.
Oh, yeah, he bought me my Korean. I forgot about that.
He bought me this little parka
with the Korean writing on it.
Well, I read this line. As a journalist, I'm reading it. He was squinting down at a parka's size tag while he spoke. It had Korean ideograms on it. And I wrote down to myself, how do you remember that? You remember, you just have, that's one of those things that sticks in your head.
It was just a weird thing. My sister pointed out something. She was just with me. We did the child abuse tour. We went back to Texas. I had this big gig in Houston, and she came down, and somebody was saying, how do you remember all this? Doctors have said I have a very high cortisol level, which is the stress hormone.
Yeah.
And apparently during like traumatic moments, guys in combat or 9/11, I know you know this from interviewing a lot of these people, you have a kind of frozen memory mm-hmm. from a really traumatic event, a car wreck or a mm-hmm. battle or something like that. So some of those memories are very vivid in these isolated, frozen kinds of ways. But mostly, if you had said, what did you wear as a coat your freshman year? Mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't have remembered it. But it's sort of like when you go back to a high school reunion and you see these middle-aged people and you say, where's the cute boy? And he's like, Fat Elvis, right?
And did I say that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. And then it's sort of like one of those little pellets that you put in water and somebody will say, remember I was in Miss Pickett's class? And you'll think, oh, yeah, I had Miss Pickett. And then I walked out, my locker was to the right. And then I went to Miss Barnes' speech class. And then I had to walk across the football field where the boy I had a crush on was playing in the eighth grade. And I would always, like, see if he was looking at me, which he never one time was. But I was convinced any moment he would realize my inner beauty and come to his senses and throw himself at my feet.
Guys at that age, they don't care about inner beauty.
So in some ways, the horrifying things, I write these books, and they're actually, I didn't know this was vetting. I just sent them to anyone who was alive, still alive in them, to read them to see what I had gotten wrong. It's almost more horrifying that my memory became my family memory, that they didn't change and add things, or that Dooney, when I sent him Cherry or Lit, or John Cleary, those Clarice, Meredith was alive through the end of Cherry. So she read that entire mm-hmm. manuscript. She died right when it had just come out. But they never changed. And to me, that's almost more horrifying. It's like, well, don't you remember anything else? I mean, this was such a big deal to me. And they're like, no, as soon as you put it down, I knew that was just how it happened. And I was just, it's sort of almost creepy. Because you know that memory and imagination inform each other. I know that I'm wrong. I tell people all the time, but I'm not intentionally ever making anything up. I really have this kind of image in my mind.
I agree with you, what you said about James Frye. You know,
this isn't hard.
It didn't happen, yeah. But nevertheless, this is your reality.
Well, I make that very clear. One of the other things I do, and I think this is why people don't get mad at me, when I write about them. Well, first off, I only write about people I pretty much really love.
That's true.
I mean, I really love my parents. I'm not like some Dickens orphan thinking, and then my mommy hit me on the head with a brick again. I could barely see. You know, I didn't grow up in Rwanda. You know, I grew up white in the richest country in America, yeah, on the planet. You know, I have many privileges. And I forgot what I was saying. I'm postmenopausal. I get to do that.
I said, this is your reality.
Oh, I never speculate about what other people are thinking. So I don't say my ex-husband did this because his father had always blah, 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 blah.
No, it's very clearly your point of view. And sometimes you say, frequently it's Leisha, your sister.
Yeah, my
you
sister.
Say, Leisha would say this about that. She would remember it differently.
Yeah, she remembered my grandmother, who I think was like Satan incarnate, was this nice old lady who taught us how to knit. You know?
She had the mustard gas blown up her leg,
yeah,
right?
She had the mustard gas on her leg,
oh,
and she
man.
Had a, you know, this really like World War I war injury amputation. And was scary to me. Plus, she had a brain tumor, and she was nuts. And my sister, my sister would remember that she was a nice old lady, but she also voted for Ronald Reagan twice, I say parenthetically. So she can write her own damn book, you know.
I agree.
But I don't think when anybody reads, say, in Lit, that I want to hit my perfectly nice ex-husband over and over on the head with a mallet. I don't think anybody reads that and thinks, oh, what a horrible person he was.
No, you know, I kind of like the guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, the whole white bread thing, that was
he was so white.
Bread.
Can I tell you about my ex-husband? I meet the 6'5" Harvard graduate who plays a really waspy sport. I think I say he rode crew, which he didn't. And he can quote more Shakespeare than anybody I've ever met. I'm 25. And he looks like the guy who played Superman, like Christopher Reeve. He's just this gorgeous guy. And I just think, you might as well walk out with your hands up, buddy. It is over for you. Well, when he brings me home to his parents, he takes me through these big wrought iron gates. And we go by the stables with the thoroughbreds. We have the little donkeys with them. And then we go by the swimming pool and the tennis courts. And I said, is this a subdivision? And he said, this is my house. This is on Long Island, about a half an hour from New York City. And I said, why didn't you tell me about all this? And he said, about all what? Which made him the perfect husband for me. He was going to have to ignore a lot of things. And I've said it before, the average well-bred American wasp can ignore reality better than any heroin addict. The added advantage that they won't steal your television. So, you know, go wasp.
He tried, though.
Oh, God. My mother decides to start drinking at my rehearsal dinner with the first time she meets the Whitbreads. She decides to start drinking. She gets her hair done up like a drag queen. Like, she gets high. She smokes a joint with my hairdresser. He's closed the salon down for these two hairdressers. She comes in and she looks like all glassy-eyed. Her head looks like a big topiary. And we go wheeling down, you know, Storrow Drive, you know, past Harvard. I'm just thinking, oh, I'm trying to get her hair down, trying to comb it, get it down. And she says to my father-in-law at dinner, which I didn't hear, my sister reported this, she said, she was a painter, my mother. I guess she offered to paint him in the nude. Oh, yeah.
What did he say?
Winning hearts and minds all over the world. He proposed to her. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. So anyway, we actually have a very happy divorce. We're happy divorce people. We tried very hard to stay married.
Somewhere in there in Lit, you say, you make obscene gestures at the rafters.
And to God.
That's God, right? I do this too.
So great.
So what is it about with you?
He's such an amateur sometimes, God.
He's a comedian, I think.
Well,
he's a comedian.
Your God's a comedian. Yeah. You know, my God's a mad scientist when I get mad at him. No, I when I started praying, I didn't have enough piety to believe that there was a God, not to give him the finger. I didn't understand. And in some ways, a priest later told me, well, at least you were honestly telling him how you felt. And I think the fact that I was in honest conversation, I think in some ways made it easier for me to connect with him, her, it, whatever. I don't think it's the guy with the beard, just FYI.
I told a priest in confession once that I get really angry and argue with, well, I'm not arguing, I'm just spewing. And he said, well, then you must have very strong faith.
That's right. It's very strange. Yeah, no, I'm somebody for who, my faith has been very hard won. I mean, I made it to the mental Marriott I surrendered in a way. It was a moment. It was a turning point in my life, and I've never had that was, gosh, 20 years ago now. Mm-hmm. Never had a drink, never had a serious depression. I made $9,000 the year I got sober, started praying to baby Jesus. And a man called me up 3 weeks at the Joe on the Bone said, what do you want to pray for? I said, I want more money. She said, well, why don't you pray for it? I said, you can pray for that? She said, sure, why not? So I was like, okay. I'd get on my knees, I'd say, okay, I made $9,000 this year, whatever you are. I'd like 12. Next year, I don't need health insurance because Michael has it. I'd explain the detail. And within 3 days, I had like an overhead projection, laser-pointed presentation where I made it quite plain I needed 15. So 3 weeks into this, a guy called me and gave me $35,000. I'm not even making this up. Now, no one has ever given me $35,000. I mean, my mother wouldn't have given me bail, you know. So Joe on the Bone says, well, so now you believe in God, you pray. I ended up doing these prayer exercises over, the Jesuits do them over 30 days as part of their novitiate. If you're a layperson, you can do them over 30 weeks. And it was a very dark time, a very arid time, as they say in prayer, where I really felt very disconnected. It was over Lent. In Lent, in these exercises, you pray to know your sinfulness and all its ugliness. It's not pretty. In the prayers, it's a whole series of complicated thing, very dark time. And I had been given these three pieces of scripture to pray with every morning. So I was at my mother's house. I had just blown up at her the section that Brian read where I essentially say all the mean things you can say to a little old lady who's just moved out of her house and is dying, essentially, and made her feel as bad as I could possibly make her feel. And had these horrible nightmares all night. And the next morning I get up and I realize I've left my Bible on the plane. And I'm like, just like you, God, to make me forget my Bible on the plane. Why didn't you remind me? you know?
What a jerk.
Really, what a jerk.
Yeah. Jerkette, whatever.
Yeah. And so I go and we just moved my mother. We got these boxes of books. Well, one of the books is her Bible that was given to her in 1922 by her mother. And I open up to the first psalm, Psalm 51, you know, it's like, cleanse me with hyssop, you know, wash me whiter than snow. You know, I'll take away your stone heart and give you a new heart. All that happy horse dookie you get at Easter. And it was underlined in blue chalk. And my mother's little childhood Bible, I thought, that's really amazing.
From 1927 was
given. That's right, I'm sorry, 27, I said 22.
Which also happened to be when your favorite team had its greatest team ever.
That's right. Go Yankees.
Murderer's Row.
So the next one is a passage from, I believe it was James. I have it written down, I don't remember, but I believe it was James.
Yes, that's right.
And I go and look, and there are 12 lines. I was given 13 lines to read, and 12 of them are marked in blue chalk.
And no other marks in the
And there are no other marks in the Bible. And as I say in the book, this is not a bullet coming in this side of your helmet and coming out, and your head is okay. This is not a burning bush. This is not, a tumor from cancer vanishing for no reason. But it was such a moving, it was one of those moments in my faith where you feel like that it's true, that, you know, the very hairs on your head are numbered and I have chosen you. And I remember saying to my mother the next day, crying and showing her this, and she said, oh, I knew we were supposed to be together. I always knew we were supposed to be together. And my sister, the physicist, said, somebody on the internet accused me of making that up. Like, that I would make that up. I was like, why wouldn't I make up something better than that? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, really? Why wouldn't I make up a tumor growing out of my head that went away or something? So, but it is that moment where I felt like I was supposed to be here. Like I was a creature. I was a little created unit. I always like that line in Hunter Thompson, you know, one of God's little prototypes, never even considered for mass production. and I sort of felt that way.
I'm going to ask Mary one more annoying question, and then I'd like...
Well, if you guys have any questions.
Yes, we're going to ask you. So I'm going to ask, so whatever we do here to
make
let everybody out there ask questions, do it.
Make it so,
God.
Number one.
So tell us, how do you pray?
Well, I have a lot of different methods of prayer. I do centering prayer, usually, you know, where you do a mantra or you count. I count my breaths 1 to 10, or I'll have a mantra that I say, or a psalm, often the Jesus prayer. I pray on my knees. I do something called Lectio Divina.
What's that?
That's where you have a little piece of the liturgy for the day. Go to prayasyougo.com, Irish Jesuits website. They always have a little Catholic liturgy. We don't want to spend too much time with the Bible as Catholics.
It's more fun on the internet.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, then you podcast it. You don't even have to read. You know, you don't want to break a sweat or anything. And I learned all kinds of methods of prayer. At night, I do something called an examine of conscience, where you are supposed to go over your day and kind of look at the graces you've received from God. But I also have to pray kind of throughout the day. As I say to my, you know, living in New York City is a great barometer for your spiritual condition, because if you want to take out everybody in your subway car with a flamethrower, you know, your spiritual condition needs fine-tuning. So I have to pray a lot during the day, and I pray about what to write. I ask God to give me, you know, a true sentence. As Hemingway said, you only need one true sentence. I do something called the triple colloquy. I mean, they sound like things you do on a balance beam, don't they? The triple colloquy.
Yeah.
I do a prayer that I thought I'd made, a form of prayer that I thought I made up, that my Tibetan Buddhist monk friend says is actually a Buddhist meditation, where Christians say you're supposed to pray, and when you see faces, you imagine they're Jesus. But I know, Brian, you're not Jesus. I'm sorry to tell you this. But I'll see faces, and I'll try to imagine myself actually in their bodies. So I don't imagine them as Jesus, but I try to imagine myself as them. And it actually does a strange thing. I mean, if you're kind of walking through a city, crowded city, people actually, if you really try to do it, begin to look very particular, and they stop looking like traffic or the enemy, and they start looking like, you know, just a lady in a blue dress, you know, probably wondering what's on the stove tonight, you know, or something. You begin, so it's a kind of opening up to fellow human being, which is what Jesus calls us to be. That's what I'm angling for.
What if Jesus Christ wrote a memoir?
He did.
Not really.
He had people do it for him.
You have been listening to author Mary Carr during her recent appearance at the Traverse City National Writers Series. The next guest in this series is Tom Brokaw, author of The Greatest Generation. For ticket information, please visit the TC National Writers Series website at www.nationalwritersseries.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, this is Aaron Stander. Thank you.